The following program is brought to you by Podcast One. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Now here's your host, Rory O'Malley.
Hey there. Welcome to the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. I'm your host, Rory O'Malley. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. My guest this week is Larissa Fasthorse, the author of the current play at the Geffen Playhouse called The Thanksgiving Play. She's pretty incredible. She is talking about what it's like to be a Native American playwright. And I guess she gets into why calling her a Native American playwright isn't very accurate. I got a lot of education from this conversation, which I really appreciate. But the play itself is hilarious. It's a comedy about Thanksgiving and what she calls the performative wokeness of our culture, especially here in Los Angeles, which I think you all can appreciate. This is my conversation with Larissa Fasthorse. Hi, Larissa.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being on the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. We're very happy to have you here because you have a play at the Geffen Playhouse right now called The Thanksgiving Play. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. It's really exciting. I've seen this play produced a few times already.
Yeah.
So getting to see, though, each director and how they change it is pretty exciting.
Right.
So I'm really excited about this one. It's going to be good.
Can you tell us a little bit about the play? Clearly, we know it's about the holiday, Thanksgiving. But what made you write this play and what's it about?
I'll tell you what it's about first. The official kind of synopsis is it's about four white folks, white presenting people at least, trying to devise.
I present as very translucent white.
Yes, you do.
I'm pale.
I'm looking at him right now.
Very
it's
pale
true.
Man.
four white presenting folks who are trying to devise a politically correct Thanksgiving play that also honors Native American Heritage Month, which is basically my life. But it's also about what I call performative wokeness and the way that we call ourselves, woke and,
right.
and with it and the ways that that can paralyze us and cause us to tie ourselves in such knots for fear of making a mistake.
Right.
And it's also about truth and like what is truth and who writes what we call truth and why do we believe it and what was their reason for writing it.
Right. It's funny that you have this play about all this with four white people. Is that on purpose or like why is that the case?
Yeah. So as a Native American playwright, almost not quite all of them, but most of my plays have had Native American characters in them
right.
in some way. And I was getting really tired of the fact that American theater has been great to me. They commission my plays and they produce them, but then they don't get further productions. Usually, I think only get ever like two productions generally. And I was told again and again the main reason was casting. That I had one play that has one half Native American character in it, and I was told it was uncastable. And I was like, wow, that's...
I'm standing right here.
Thousands, actually.
Yeah.
Millions of us are.
Yeah.
And I just was getting really frustrated. I felt like I kind of hit a wall. I've been doing this for a dozen years, and like I said, it's been good to me. It's all I do. It's my whole-time job is writing plays. However, that was just a wall I just couldn't seem to get through. And so I said, fine, American theater. I had this two-week residency in Ireland from the Guthrie, and they said, just write whatever you want. Just spend some time at this artist retreat.
Where in Ireland?
It's in a place called Enniscorthy.
Okay.
Which is actually Tyrone Guthrie's wife's family estate. They call
wow.
it Tyrone Guthrie's home.
Yeah.
But of course it wasn't. It was,
it was his
family's home.
Come on.
But
yeah.
Patriarchy.
Right.
It's been set up. It was set aside on his death as this beautiful artist retreat that was originally really coolly meant to unite Northern Ireland and Ireland. And there was a requirement that they had to have artists from both countries. And this was in the height of the war.
Right.
And it, they continue to honor that. So you get this really interesting mix of people there of all disciplines that also are a lot of original Irish.
Okay.
And then people from both the north and from down there. It's one of the few estates in the northern part of Ireland, not Northern Ireland, but the northern part of Ireland, that was not burned down because Sir Tyrone Guthrie and his family were known to be sympathizers with the Irish, even though they are English themselves. And so it wasn't destroyed. So I went there and I said, hey, what am I going to do? And I thought, okay, American theater, you know, as long as I'm sitting here in Ireland, let's write something about white people, and, but about indigenous issues. And I made that my challenge. And it, in the end, you know, I'm really happy with what came out of that challenge. I love this play. It says all the things I want to say, but it just does it in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, it is actually a window into a conversation about race and being woke and about who we are, because that's important right now, I should say, because as the whitest person anyone's ever met, you know, so many of my conversations that I have are with other white people solving racism with other white people, right? and really not getting out of themselves or their communities or their bubbles to figure out what's really going on or what's really necessary. But this is a comedy. This is a really, really funny, funny play. Why is comedy the way that you chose to tell this story?
I actually describe this one as a comedy within a satire. So the play, the whole overarching, you know, experience is a pretty pointed satire. But within it, I put this comedy, these comedy things within the situation of these characters that are very funny and meant to just be purely funny to anybody. And for me, that I always call that the sugar that makes the medicine go down. You know,
right.
Overall, it's quite it's got a lot of pretty pointed issues that we're raising and really real things and about the way our by our, I mean, indigenous people's cultures are appropriated and always, even our genocides are appropriated, our pain is appropriated to make white people feel better about themselves because they can show the pain and show the horrors and that somehow makes them better people. I don't know. So, you know, it shows all these different things. But in the middle of that all, I do give us a lot of laughs. And it's a mix of laughs, you know. I always say when there's a couple jokes, you know, there's certainly unifying jokes that everybody gets, but then there'll be one joke will come up and I'll be like, oh, there's where all the native people are, or oh, there's all the people of color, you know, I can find them in the room.
Right.
Because things are written specifically to them
as
well as everybody else.
Now let's get back into why you started writing and performing. Where did you grow up?
South Dakota.
South Dakota.
Yeah, that's where my tribe is from.
And so what was that like? How did you get into theater and performing?
You know, it's still all these years and thousands of plays later, I say I'm not a theater person. I wasn't.
Really?
Yeah, I wasn't a theater kid. I was a classical ballet dancer, which in South Dakota is pretty rare. We moved off the reservation to the town of Pierre, South Dakota, which at that time was 13,000 people, which in South Dakota is a metropolis. Now it's like not
city. Even,
you know, a high school here in LA.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I moved there and was taking ballet and for lots of reasons, which will be in a play with I'm doing with Che Yu. But you can see that in a couple of years. But I started doing ballet and really fell in love with that. But I was the only one. I was the only dancer I knew, the only person I knew trying to be a dancer, like in my entire state, ballet dancer specifically. So all my friends were either in, you know, choir and band and theater. And so I was kind of on the sidelines of it all, but I was not a theater kid. So even today, you know, there's a lot of theater references in this play, in the Thanksgiving play. And I just took them from, like, other playwright friends. Like, actually, the director, Michael John Garces, I was sharing an office at Cornerstone Theater Company, where he's artistic director, when I was writing this play and after I got back from Ireland. And I'd be like, hey, Michael, I need, you know, a play that, you know, will fit this joke. And I believe, you know, and he actually is a theater person and knows theater. So he gave me all like my references because I just don't have that background in theater.
Right.
Because I was in ballet first until I was, you know, 30 years old. And then I worked in film and television for a little while and wasn't very happy there. And theater found me. I got commissioned and fell in love.
Wow. You are a storyteller from the beginning, though. Like, was your dance, did you tell story through dance, or was it, your culture, being a Native American and having a tribe, and like, so much of the stories and the culture is passed on through storytelling and that tradition. Do you see any, like, crossover in where you came from and growing up in a tribe in theater?
Yeah. So, I mean, I grew up quite a bit. Sounds crazy because it's only 100 miles away, but 100 miles where I'm from is pretty far away from my tribe. And so I definitely grew up much more in Western culture.
Okay.
In a lot of ways. My parents were really great about trying to find mentors and people for me, positive examples of Lakota culture and teachers for me through my life, but it was separated from kind of the central reservation. Like, I didn't grow up with my language, you know. I knew words here and there, but I've never been even close to fluent. So for me, you know, I feel like ultimately, you know, then I, as an adult, I really threw a lot of energy into getting a lot of the cultural education I'd missed when I was younger. And then realized along the way through ballet, you know, having the career in ballet, I was a balancing dancer, so it's really the like storyless ballets. There isn't really much story in any of them, even though I always created characters and created emotion and that sort of thing through
it's
what I did.
It's more about the technique.
Yeah, and just about connecting with people. And that I know how to do. Like, I know how to, you know, step on a stage and make an emotional arc with people just through movement and just that thing you have inside, you know, that you can send to them and bring, you know, bring that energy back from them and feed on each other. Like, I understand that. I understand how to hold an audience, and I understand how to do that from years of being a performer. I was actually a really bad technician, but I was a really good performer. And so I really just had to take those skills and translate them into words and writing. As I've been going through my career now, I've with Michael John Garces, the director of this play, and Cornerstone Theater Company, I've been spending a lot of years now working with Indigenous communities and learning different Indigenous storytelling and theater techniques, and then infusing them into sort of a pseudo-Western experience that we create. And so we create these large experiential theatrical events with Native people, different Indigenous populations, and blend the two together. And that's really what I do well. I call myself a translator. I know how to translate Indigenous issues and culture into something that white people can understand, and I also know how to do it in the reverse. And often these pieces that Michael and I have been creating are somewhere in between.
Right. Wow. So you started dancing, you were doing that, and then you decided you wanted to become a writer. How did you take that first step, though? Like, I've talked to a lot of people who've become writers, but not many dancers who became writers. So how did you make that first step?
Yeah, the ballerina playwright is a pretty small group.
Yeah,
not a lot of us. I don't even know if I've met another one. I actually went to first an incredible organization. I didn't know what I wanted to do next. You know, I thought I was going to teach. I tried teaching. I was like, ooh, I'm too young. I'm not ready. I'm too selfish. I got more to do. I thought I'd do musical theater. And I was really lucky. I got cast as like a principal in a horrible musical, but it was a beloved musical at the time. And I was like, wow, no, I don't have the artistic sensibility to do the same thing, because I come from ballet where you're doing a new show every few weeks, you know, and to do the same thing over and over again. You know, I did like 400 of the same show in less than a year. You know, I couldn't do it.
Yeah. People don't realize that's really the job of that, is doing something over and over again and not going insane.
Yeah. I don't know how you do it. That's an incredible skill that I just didn't have.
Just numb yourself completely.
There you go. I obviously didn't do that well enough. So I tried those things, did a little bit of acting since I was here in LA where my husband's from. And then I found Career Transitions for Dancers, which is now under the Actors Fund.
Right.
At the time, it was still a separate organization, and it's funded by all the different unions, performing unions. And they were amazing. I wouldn't be who I am today without them. I had almost 3 years of weekly career counseling and coaching, and provided entirely for free, you know, to help me figure out what to do next. And I'd always done a lot of reading and a lot of writing. My dad's, you know, degrees in sociology, and he worked in criminology, and my mother's a librarian. And so reading and writing were so much a part of just our everyday, literally everyday life.
Wow.
And so it just was a matter of figuring out, like, I love writing, but I had to find a way to kind of focus it into something that, you know, was sellable in a career and a job.
Right.
And because I was here in L.A., film and TV just made the most sense. And because I don't have a degree in anything, because I was dancing instead of going to college, it's working, I thought, well, you know, that's something you don't need a degree to do. I mean, anyone, if you can talk, you can write dialogue.
Sure.
You know? And so I started there, and I worked in film and TV for a few years before theater found me.
What were the things that you loved about TV and film and the stuff that you were like, no, I've got to find something else in theater that made you move on?
Yeah, I think I loved, you know, just film and TV taught me, obviously, script format, but it also taught me how to be a really concise writer. You know, you don't get to waste time on TV. You got to get to the point. You have to make things happen through dialogue quickly. You have to be really concise. And I remember, you know, having mentors who'd be like, well, this person's saying this with 7 words. Can they say it with 5? Okay, they're saying it with 5 words. Can they say it with 3? You know, like, and
right.
It really taught me how to do really quick, smart dialogue. The other thing, though, that I didn't figure this out, actually, I can't remember who now. A dramaturg figured this out for me. But she said, you know, because what my commissions in theater, which I'm fortunate, I work under commission all the time, you know, that's my bread and butter, they get produced, you know,
right.
all the time. And she said, well, Larissa, that's because you came from TV. You understand deadlines. You understand how to turn something in. You understand how to not be precious.
Right.
You don't, you know, you make things fit an audience. You know, when I get a commission, I visit the theater, I get to know their audience, and I write something for them. You
right.
know, I'm not like sitting around. I don't know. This sounds horrible because I don't know what playwrights are taught. But I hear them talking about like being so precious about their what they want to say and how they want to say it and their words. And I'm like, you know, there's an infinite number of words. You can use them. You can get rid of them. You can always get them back. Like, you
right.
don't run out, you know. So just let them go. Don't hold on to them.
Right.
And I really use my words to serve the audience that I've been hired to write for. And I deliver very quickly, always ahead of schedule.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of times a writer in a writer's room working on TV or film has to really be a problem solver, has to really feel like, okay, how can we get this done now? And it, even in your casting or creating the characters and being like, how can we tell this story now? We're going to have to make these 4 white characters so that nobody can say, oh, we just can't produce this. So we're telling this story now.
Yeah, totally. Well, and even with a play like, you know, the Thanksgiving play, I very intentionally made it kind of a director's piece, you know, because there's large sections, especially these things I call the interstitials. So every other scene are these interstitials that are drawn from, unfortunately, the internet, from contemporary time, of things that we're still teaching to children that are deeply problematic. But if you look at the script, it says, you know, do anything. Maybe it's puppets. Maybe
right.
it's projection. Maybe it's live. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's 100 different things, you know. And I really, throughout, and there's lots of large physical action and a lot of physical comedy
right.
that I very much say, here's what you're getting to. Do it however you want. Like, I really want it to reflect every director. And I don't know. There's something I love that. Like, it's funny. I talk to some writers, and they're like, oh, my goodness. But how do you know what they're going to do it wrong? Or I was like, there's no wrong. That's the cool
yeah.
thing. Like, I love collaborative working. And that's what, you know, I learned in TV, right, is how to work. I was a creator. But still, you learn how to work collaboratively with so many people. And I, you know, that's what I love about, like, this production. It's completely different from every other production I've seen. And I think that's great. That's exciting to me.
It's especially important with comedy because you can't just like put comedy into a box. It really is
yeah.
dependent on those actors and that night. It's dependent on the audience.
Very much, yeah.
And wherever it is. So yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, so let's go back. You decide you want to be a writer. What was the first play that you wrote, and what did it feel like to put it out there in the world for the first time?
Yeah, it was horrifying. My first play was my first commission I had with Children's Theater Company of Minneapolis with Peter Brocious. It was this huge, ridiculous, crazy play because I didn't know how to write a play. I had no idea. And, you know, it was like the best and the worst place to start. I started, you know, they were under like a Lord A or Lord B contract at the time. I mean, it's huge. You know,
yeah.
This is their main stage. It was a huge contract. I had a lot of attention. And it was horrifying that, like, you know, I didn't get a chance to, like, try it out in a little black box or try
right.
playwriting, you know, in school. Or I didn't, you know, I started on, you know, with 1,000 seats and
right.
had to and they're little people yeah. that have no patience.
Yeah.
So it was amazing. And you know, to start out with those resources, with a 10-person cast and 2 live fires on stage and a massive pond and a full, you know, forest of actual trees and, you know, just all the things that I had, the resources I had were a pretty incredible way to start out. But the other thing I had that was really informed my entire career and made sense to me coming from film and TV was I had Peter Brosius was director, and then I had this team of designers that he considered designer dramaturgs.
Hmm.
And so they were very much my team. I had just one designated dramaturg, but I had all these designers that worked as dramaturgs also. And so everything was a team effort. Like, I remember, you know, we were in, I think, our first week of previews on this huge, crazy thing. And there was video. There was so much. And I remember it was like 2:30 in the morning, and these designer dramaturgs are all still sitting with me,
wow.
trying to help me solve something. It's like, well, maybe you don't have to do a script. Maybe I can do it this light cue. Maybe I can do this. And like, they still had to like refocus in the morning,
yeah.
and they still had to record stuff. They still had so much to do. And at 2:30 in the morning, they're just trying to help me work out my problem, you know. And that really, you know, set the tone for the rest of my career for how I work and how I'd like to collaborate in a really true way, as opposed to just like, oh, give me some input. It's like, no, here, you figure all this out.
Right.
And if you need help, I'll help you and you help me. And I don't care who comes up with whatever idea. I just want the best idea in the room.
Right. It takes a lot of trust
mm-hmm.
in your fellow artists that you're working with. And,
yeah.
And sometimes in other mediums, that's hard to do. I think a lot of people, especially when things are moving so quickly, they don't trust anyone but themselves.
Yeah.
But in theater, you have to, because everything's live. Everything's in front of you. You know, it's like you have to trust your fellow actors. You have to trust your writer, because it's all happening in real time.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the most beautiful part of it and also the scariest.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because, you know, I think also, though, then there's the reverse, right? Because we also have an issue with capacity in theater and not having either the resources or the time or the whatever. Because when on my second play, you know, the director and I were like, yeah, that's how we're working together. Everything was great. And it was a much, much smaller theater company. And we went to like, you know, 6 months out to meet with all the designers together and like tell them our whole spiel. And like, we just, you know, you're an artist, you're part of this, blah, blah, blah. And talk to this, we're talking to this lighting designer. And they were like, we got done with this whole thing. We're so excited. And they said, well, on page 2, it says it's day. And then page 10, it says it's night. And we're like, right. Yes. But we're saying, you know, we're inviting you to be a part of like the whole, this is still a play in process and be a part of like the dramaturgy. And it was really fascinating because she'd never been asked those questions before. And then when we got like within a few weeks of opening, it's like I saw the light. We saw it go on, and it was kind of too late. But it's interesting to see the light go on. And I realized, oh, they really want me to say what I think, to be a creative artist with them.
Right.
And it was really a bummer because someone had worked a lot. You know, this is all she does, and she and also teaches. And she hadn't ever been given that opportunity.
Wow.
And I think that was more about like just not having the capacity of time to really work, bring the designers in early enough, and let them be a part of the creative process.
Yeah. So what is it like, though, to listen to the end result, to have an audience respond to what you've created? And I don't know, I would imagine it's a very naked feeling, a very vulnerable feeling to have responses, no matter how long you've been writing.
Oh, horrible. Yeah, it's the worst.
Can you sit,
I'm
do you
sick
sit
all
down?
The time.
Do you sit down or do you stand in the back of a theater? Like, how do you experience that?
I go wherever I can hide, usually. I actually generally in theaters, I sit on the stairs on the side, kind of about halfway down. I sneak in after the lights have gone out so that I can watch the audience from the side. And I'm also low enough, though, that they can't see me.
Right.
So that's usually my spot, is sitting on the floor. But it just, you know, depends on the space. It never isn't horrifying. I'm always sick. I'm always nervous. And I've seen this play done many times. It's the most, one of the most produced plays in the country, and I'm still sick.
No, I mean, I get it. And especially, like, coming home to Los Angeles where you live now, you know, it's got to be a different experience now that you're going to be having it in front of an LA audience, you know. Have you produced theater in Los Angeles before? Have you done a show here?
Hilariously, it's only my third show in my whole career in L.A.
Wow.
My second show was at Native Voice at the Autry, and then Michael and I did Urban Res with Cornerstone Theater Company, outdoors, and then this is it. The Geffen.
It's a pretty big one.
Yeah.
But do you have like any preconceived notions about what an LA audience is? Because I mean, I've lived in Los Angeles for years now, and I know there's a certain crowd that Geffen subscribers and Geffen Playhouse is great. They're so supportive, but it's like it's very different from producing it in Sacramento, where this has also been, or other cities, you know, around the country. So what are you expecting from an LA audience with this play?
I'm really excited about it. We've had two readings here in Los Angeles while I was developing the play, and the play is set definitely not in Los Angeles,
right?
Because Los Angeles is the butt of a lot of jokes in this
sure.
play, because there is an actress from L.A.
Right.
And so what I love about L.A., I've lived here my entire adult life, is that Angelenos love to laugh at themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And they get being the butt. They love being the butt of the joke.
They do. They have a good sense of humor
about
it.
Yeah, they really do.
They just laugh in the sunshine.
They're exactly.
Like, ha, 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 yeah. But we're in the sun.
Exactly. And now we're going to the beach.
Yeah.
It was really fun. The two times I've had it read here, I mean, the audience was out of control. I mean, we added probably 10 minutes to the show because they were having such a great time.
Well, and it's also because of laughing or making fun of the woke culture, or thinking that you're woke without actually knowing a lot about what's necessary, and not really what did you say? You said performative
wokeness. Yeah. I live in Santa Monica. It's the epicenter of performative wokeness.
Yeah, this is definitely.
Although we now have a satellite in Silver Lake.
So I mean, it's definitely something that should be put in front of audiences here in Los Angeles. I think they're going to, even though it's not taking place there, they're going to recognize a lot of it.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's interesting because, the Geffen Playhouse in the last few years under Matt has, you know, really seen such a shift in having such a great multi-generational mix there that, you know, wasn't as strong in the past, but it's really grown. And I'm really excited because I've seen this play done with audiences that are primarily maybe in the retirement age, and I've also seen it done with a much younger audience, and it's really fun to watch the interplay between them.
Right.
A lot of the folks that are maybe in our kind of older, more traditional theater audience, even if they aren't necessarily living the world of these characters, they're like, in talkbacks, they're like, oh my gosh, that's my grandchildren. Now I get what they're trying to do. Now I get where they're coming from. And they thought it was hilarious because they may not be living all this super woke language and this, you know, lingo that we're constantly changing every other day, but they're trying to understand it. So they're seeing it from a different viewpoint than, say, the millennials are right in the middle of this fight.
Yes. Yeah. And they are in the middle of it. Like, I'm trying to catch up. I don't think of myself as being, like, too much older than millennials. Mm-hmm. My husband says I am not. I was born in 1980, so it's like that, like, my birthday is basically the cutoff.
Yeah,
everyone after
you're right
me
on
is.
The border.
Yeah, exactly. But, I realize that in a lot of the conversations around being woke and understanding the shift in culture, that I have a lot of work to do. You know, I'm trying to understand when people are putting their pronouns on an email, to be sensitive to it, to understand, and also, like, what do I have to tell people about my pronouns, or is that, you know, like, I don't, there's a lot of stuff, but obviously talking about Native American culture is no one is talking enough about it.
Yeah.
And it's so, so important. What are some of the misperceptions about the culture that you think that white people need to understand and also, like, not take ownership of, as you were saying before?
Yeah. So much. How much time do we have?
We've got all day.
So it's going to be a 5-hour podcast, people. There's a lot. I mean, with this play specifically, right, we talk a lot about Thanksgiving, obviously.
Yeah.
I'll have to admit, I did not realize how – I mean, I was new – Thanksgiving is problematic, but how deeply, deeply, deeply problematic it is, how completely wrong it is. Like, the lies that we've told about the tribes that were in that region of, you know, what we now call the kind of Thanksgiving time, which really spans like 100 years, actually, when you look at what we're talking about. And how they're not even their culture, just the idea. That's the thing. It's not even that we have appropriated and misinterpreted and changed and lied about like the culture of those people, but like it's not even real. It's a mythology that we've created that is in no way connected to who these actual people were and what actually happened. You know, some of the horrible like massacres and things that were happening that are actually, you know, around Thanksgiving and were actually the basis of this holiday, we just leave out of our narrative because the narrative of Thanksgiving was created after the Civil War as a secular way to reunite the country under the banner of gratitude. It was one thing that Lincoln thought he could get both the North and the South to, like, let's just be grateful. We won't say for what. We won't, you know, we won't make any judgments. We're just going to all be grateful. We can do that. And they created this mythology of these people. And so that's like a perfect example of what keeps happening is that we create mythologies of indigenous people and cultures and use them for our own means and our own benefits. Mm-hmm. You know, my people are constantly misrepresented in everything. I'm from the Lakota people and we are the, you know, headdress Indians and the teepee Indians and all that. And just the way we're used in popular culture and the way that we're endlessly appropriated, you know, headdress is an easy one. It seems like an easy one, right? We're all like, we kind of should all know now, you know what? Don't wear a headdress. And yet it's endless, 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 endless. Often I see them done, including in plays like On the Town uses a really disrespectful red face headdress moment in a really hurtful way. But, you know, but it's considered, it's funny, it's humor, it's tradition, it's what we've been doing for a long time. I think, though, a lot of the reasons that things continue, you know, I mean, like I said, I can go on and on. Like just the other day in our rehearsal room, a woman of color said, sitting right next to me, well, I don't want to be an Indian giver, but. And I was like, wow, did you really just say that? And she was like, oh.
Right.
And she did what most people do, which is hilarious. She said, oh, you know, I've never said that before. I was like, well, that's actually worse because now you're saying I've chosen this moment sitting next to a native person to say it for the first time. Like, that's pretty hostile.
Yeah.
I think I'd go with, sorry, I screwed up. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of times things are, people don't know where they even come from. Mm-hmm. It's not an excuse, but it certainly is like you have to educate yourself to understand why you're saying something. Don't say it if you don't know why.
Yeah,
you know,
right?
I mean, and I, you know, look, I come from Cleveland, Ohio. Okay. So I went to many baseball games, seeing protests outside and not understanding at all. I can't say like I haven't had to educate myself because I definitely have. And it's hard for me because I know that, excuse me, there are a lot of family members and people who don't want to educate themselves, who don't want to hear. And I remember seeing protests and thinking, move aside, like let's have fun, not knowing or wanting to. And I think how silly that is, that whatever tradition I'm holding up of baseball or a city is holding up of, you know, well, this is how it's been, how you're mocking tradition or a people of centuries. And if I can't examine myself in that, which is, it's been a process, you know, like it really has, because, you know, but I get it now. And it takes time. And it's one of those things that you look back at, you know, who you were as a kid or where you're brought in, you don't even realize. And it takes people telling stories and having those awkward conversations. So I'm really glad that the play and the rehearsal room that you're in is making those conversations happen. How do you continue to have those conversations when they're just, especially for the Native American community, which is, it's especially in the political world right now, like it's happening more and more because for certain reasons, we don't have to get into that. But especially, I can already tell that next year it might be happening a lot more. How do we continue to have those positive conversations and learn more about the Native American culture in a way that is positive for them?
Yeah.
Do you love how I'm just like, how do we solve this problem?
Yes. Native American and making quotes because that doesn't exist anyway. That's not a thing.
Right.
Is it better
to say indigenous?
Well, it's just that there isn't a Native American culture. So
one monolithic thing.
Exactly.
There are so many different tribes.
Yeah, there's
to group them all
600 some recognized, federally recognized individual sovereign nations in this country.
So you can't just say this is Native American culture.
Right.
Yeah,
you have to start with the land you're on and find out what nation you're standing in.
Right.
Like right now we're standing in the Tongva Nation. You have to start. And this is what I do, right? When I get commissioned to write for a theater company, I would say, well, whose land are we on? What nation are we in?
Right.
I don't think a lot of people don't understand. Like, I'm, by federal law, I am a member of my tribal nation, the Tsanga Lakota Nation. That's my first citizenship.
Right.
And then I also have citizenship that only was granted less than 100 years ago, the United States of America.
Right.
So I have dual citizenship with two independent sovereign nations that it happened to coexist in the same geographic space. A lot of people don't even understand that. So people don't know like the real just even basics. My belief personally is, a lot of people don't want to really understand because the truth is, you look at slavery. Like we can say, well, we ended slavery. So now let's look at African-American history and have February and celebrate it and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. We fought in World War II. It took us a while, but we finally fought in World War II, mm-hmm. got rid of Hitler. We can talk about that, this is still going on.
Yeah.
We're still occupying lands that the federal government, the Supreme Court has upheld should be returned. And the government just says, yes, but no. Here's some money. Take that.
Right.
We don't want your money. We want our land back.
Right.
And so it's a hard thing because it's not resolved. And it's not something we can, as a country, look back on and say, ooh, wow, let's face that tough truth and move on.
And because the people who were wronged were nearly wiped out completely, slaughtered, like a minority of a minority of a minority. Like, it's hard mm-hmm. to have much of a voice when you've literally been exterminated.
Yeah.
It's
genocide.
Just, yeah. So it's important that these stories are told. And I think that you are such a wonderful person to tell them because of all the reasons that, of who you are, your background, and you can talk to white people and tell the story of these people and understand the tool of humor and the power of theater and storytelling in that way. And I think that laughter is a good entry point into having these conversations, right?
Yeah, right. Because that's fun too. Like, who doesn't want to just come? This is the only place you do this, right?
Right.
The only place you come together. Even when you see a movie that's like funny, you rarely hear the whole audience laughing out loud.
Right.
In this play, so much of the play, you're going to hear everybody laughing and just like, guffawing and like, just really real laughter. And you don't get to experience that in a group. It feels so good.
Yeah.
But at the same time, my plays always ask more questions than they answer. Hmm. I would say the second act of my plays happen after the lights have gone down. They have, if my plays aren't either causing you discomfort or to think or to ask questions or to have a conversation, then I've failed. Hmm. My goal is to give you more than just a little bit of, talk on the way home, but something that you're still considering and thinking that you have to do something about the next day.
Well, I'm sure that this play does because this conversation has done that for me. I'm going to continue to educate myself about this topic, and I'll certainly be thinking about it at Thanksgiving this year. You can check out the Thanksgiving play at the Geffen Playhouse, which is running through the first week of December. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Larissa. I really appreciate you coming on and having this conversation with us.
Can't
wait to see the show.
Great.
That was Larissa Fasthorse, the author of the current play at the Geffen Playhouse, the Thanksgiving play. Thank you so much for listening. Please remember to download, rate, review the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, brought to you by Podcast One.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to download new episodes every month right here on Podcast One, on the Podcast One app, or on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to rate, review, and share.